The structural integrity of a building is, especially during an earthquake, is a major factor in architectural design and construction. A building can look right on the outside, it can even look right on the inside, but appearances can be deceiving, and internal materials that are used or structural design can be, well, less than what's specified, and dodgy construction methods can be covered over by all sorts of plaster and paint, and we just don't know what's there underneath. Well, every year there seem to be new news reports around the world of large multi-story buildings collapsing, often resulting in serious loss of life. In fact, there's a fascinating little website that I was looking at this week about major building failures and collapses that dates all the way back to the first century. There's a modern-day parable that tells a tragic story along these lines. It goes like this. An architect was commissioned to design a multi-story office block for a large company. Now, the architect and his engineers surveyed the land and the geotechnical report on the proposed site, and they discovered, of course, that the building would be constructed on unstable land and on an earthquake fault line. It would therefore need to be capable of withstanding a major earthquake. Well, after many months, the plans were completed and handed over to the construction company. And if they were followed explicitly, then the building would withstand a massive earthquake. However, that's where the problems began. The first part of the construction was the digging of the foundation, and the plans specified a certain depth, taking into account the extra stability that would be required and the need for the building to reach bedrock. However, the foreman in charge of excavation and construction of the foundations looked at the plans and questioned whether they were really necessary to go that deep. He'd built dozens of other buildings near this one. The foundations had never had to go down that far, and so he basically made a judgment call and instructed his men to ignore the architect's plans and to dig the foundations half the specified depth. Next came the steel fixing, and the rods of iron that are tied or welded together inside the concrete give it strength. The architect's plans specified specifically a certain thickness and a high tensile steel along with narrower than normal spacing. More expensive, but this will be necessary in order to give the building strength. However, as you'd imagine, the foreman in charge of the steelwork disagreed with the architect's specifications. Based on his past experience, he instructed his men to use thinner and cheaper steel with wider spacing. And so the construction of the building went on. Shortcut here, shortcut there. Disregard the architect's detailed specifications time and again. And at each stage of the construction process, the various foremen disputed the architect's specifications. Well, finally, the building was completed and handed over to the company that commissioned it. It looked like what the architect had designed in terms of shape and design. However, its strength and flexibility were nothing like the original design. The company moved in, and it all appeared to be a great success, and people congratulated the architect for his design. That is, until one day, the inevitable happened, an earthquake. It wasn't a particularly large earthquake, only about half the size the building was said to be able to withstand, and yet the building came down in a crumbling heap. Hundreds of people were crushed. And the sad thing, the strange thing was, everyone turned to the architect and blamed him. The architect's ability and professional competence was slandered, and his reputation in that land was destroyed. The irony was, the collapse of the building was not his fault. The architect's design was actually perfect. If his instructions were followed, the building would have withstood an earthquake twice the size, and yet everyone blamed the architect. Throughout this year, we have been working our way through the passage in the Bible that's referred to as the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7. And today is part 20. It's the end of this particular series. The words we're going to read in a second are Jesus' summation comments to this particular set of his teaching. And they bear a remarkable resemblance to principles of design and construction, not so much about buildings as the lives that we as people construct for ourselves. Here's what he said. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house. Yet it did not fall, because it had its foundation on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell with a great crash. When Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, because he taught as one who had authority and not as their teachers of the law. When it comes to analogies around the whole theme of construction, Jesus was probably more qualified than most. I mean, history may well recall the life of Jesus of Nazareth as a great teacher, a miracle worker, and all sorts of other communication ability. But he actually began his life amidst the family business. Joseph, his father, was a carpenter in the town of Nazareth. And Jesus would have grown up understanding basic principles of construction. In fact, Mark's gospel actually refers to Jesus himself as a carpenter in his own right. And it's quite likely that after the death of Joseph, Jesus took over the family business. Of course, in those days, there were no such things as building permits or codes of compliance or geotechnical reporting on soil composition and land movement. There certainly were no such thing as construction inspectors who would check that buildings were being constructed properly. So for us today, reading this particular set of verses in the 21st century, we might think the analogy actually is a little bit silly. Who in their right mind would ever build a house in the middle of a torrent of water? But actually, in the times and the geography of Jesus, this would not have been an unheard-of scenario. Houses were constructed quickly, usually of baked mud, and it was not inconceivable that someone might find what appeared to be a lovely, shady place to build a house, only to discover after it was constructed that in the rainy season it was in an area that was prone to flooding. But of course, Jesus was not teaching his followers about house construction. He was teaching more about life construction. Is the type, is the manner with which a person builds their life, is that durable? Is it stable? Is it anchored? Or is it superficially beautiful by external appearances, until something stressful comes along and it all falls to pieces? Jesus' analogy in the verses that we've read actually is linked with the verses that go just before it. Verse 24 says that it starts with the word therefore, which is a link word, meaning that what is said next builds on what was said beforehand. And in the verses immediately before this that we actually looked at a fortnight ago, Jesus was talking there about the difference between genuine or real disciples and those who are fake. And we had that rather confronting statement, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven." Now, come the end of the age, there are going to be some surprises as to who in fact makes it into the kingdom of heaven and who does not. And being religious, evidently, is not the same thing as having a genuine relationship with God whereby we are known by him. And Jesus, in the verses that we're looking at today, gives some hints as to what it does, or what it means for us to actually have real relationship with the Lord, whereby we know him and he in turn knows us. Conclusion statements at the end of a book or the end of a chapter or the end of an essay or a paper are important to hear. That they will often sum up the essence of what has gone before. And in this particular instance, there are some valuable life principles that we do well to learn from. And the first of these that I want to draw out for us is simply this: storms are a fact of life. Jesus compares two houses that, for all intents and purposes, are exactly the same, and both of them experience the same storm or pressure. The rain comes down, the streams rise, and the winds blow. In many parts of the world today, particularly in Western countries like ours, building regulations are contingent upon protecting them from the ubiquitous 1-in-100-year flood. Well, right outside our front gate, banged into the tar seal on the road, is a peg called a datum peg that provides an official height above which all the surrounding houses in our little neighborhood must measure a certain distance from in calculating the height of the foundations in order to avoid any future possible flooding. And if Jesus was telling his story in our day and age, he may well refer to something like a datum peg. But the point of Jesus' analogy, again, was about life, not about buildings. And there are numerous storms that are common to every person in our world. We all experience them, and none of us can avoid them. Battling the elements, living with stress and difficulty, is quite simply part and parcel of life. There are storms that we face in terms of health issues, ultimately our own demise. There are storms of grief over the loss of a loved one. There are raging storms in marriages from time to time. There are tornadoes of friction within families, or anxiety over our children or our grandchildren. There are hurricanes of economic worry that buffet us from time to time. That there are storms that are common to all human beings, but for those of us who follow Jesus, there can also be storms in terms of spiritual warfare that come from the evil one, whose primary objective is to kill and destroy. But we sometimes live with this illusory hope of seasons in life where all our troubles and storms are behind us and everything now is going to be peaceful and tranquil. But, well, that's la-la land. That really is an illusion. At no point has God ever promised that we will avoid the storms of life that buffet and bully our world. We therefore ought not to be surprised by seasons in life that are like heavy weather. Rather, we need to be wise in how we plan to get through those times. And it's quite possible that for some of us today, we're actually right in the midst of storms like that. Here's a cheery piece of advice to lift your spirits from the pen of James, the younger brother of Jesus. He said, "Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds." Really? Well, he goes on, "because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. And let perseverance finish its work so that you may be mature and complete and not lacking anything." I mean, no one particularly likes going through storms in life. But they simply cannot be avoided. I mean, life is messy. Time's painful. But James was suggesting that those storms also can actually have a profound and a positive effect on us as well. Enduring the storms actually helps us grow and mature. So one of the primary points that I think Jesus wanted people to grasp is that the life we build for ourselves needs to be durable and robust, capable of bringing us through storms. We build for rain and flood and tempest. We don't just build for sunshine. Or to introduce a completely different analogy, remember the story of the three little pigs that had read to us as children. Nothing is surer than the fact that the wolf is lurking outside and he will huff and he will puff and try and blow our house down. Then a second life principle that we can draw from the words of Jesus is that durability is directly proportional to foundation. And that's the basic construction principle in Jesus' analogy. If the foundations are strong and firm, the building will be strong and firm. If the foundations are shaky or shifting, the building will be unstable and insecure. This is why, if you've ever built a house, the builders take detailed care in laying out the profiles and the foundations of the house that will emerge from them. And if you've watch them working on that, you can sometimes scratch your head and think, my goodness, they're taking an awful long time. Nothing seems to be happening. Well, actually, a lot of important things are happening because everything hinges on getting those foundations right. And so Jesus takes that basic building principle and he applies it to life. What is the foundation? What is the bedrock upon which our lives are anchored? Will they hold fast during the inevitable storms that come from time to time? Or to put that another way, what actually is the source of truth upon which we will determine our values or formulate our understanding of right from wrong? Now, taking a few moments just to think about this, this has actually become quite a controversial subject in our generation, perhaps more so than many generations in the past. Because it used to be that undergirding foundations of a society, and therefore the values that we all live by, were much more clearly understood than they seem to be today. Social norms and values or morals and ethics, they were fixed and regarded as immutable across generations. Well, that's not the world in which we live today. In what we refer to as a postmodern society, the social foundations of modernity and belief about what's right and what's wrong are constantly being questioned and challenged. Definitions of truth and facts, they're no longer definite in an age where there can be alternative facts. You can have yours, I can have mine. And who of us is to say which is right or more correct than the other? For instance, determining acceptable sexual behavior or sexual identity. These are actually highly flexible these days rather than fixed. Now, gender is now actually a matter of choice rather than observation. Who is to say which is right and which is wrong? Parents expecting a baby will marvel at the ultrasound images of life of their unborn child. I mean, our 8th grandchild was born just a few weeks ago, and we marveled in the months before that at the ultrasound scans and videos that you see of the child in the womb that shows its facial features and movement, and all the little bits and pieces are all there. Well, the same ultrasound images are seen by people in the next cubicle who reject that is actually a living being and is quite capable of being forcibly expelled from its mother's womb. The prevailing view is that the rights of the mother outweigh the rights of the unborn. Or if enough people say that mind-altering substances or the right to terminate the life of a person is okay, the law is changed. Those who appeal for an absolute moral truth and an ethic to guide our society, well, they're regarded as anachronistic and intolerant of progress. To use a boating analogy, imagine a series of boats that used to be tied to solid moorings or anchored to the seabed. When winds and currents tried to move them, they remained steadfast. Today, the prevailing worldview is less about anchoring to the seabed in favor of tying all the boats to each other. Our culture is a bit like a sea of boats that are lashed together, drawing solidarity and courage and perspective on normality from each other as the storms come our way. We're not anchored to anything secure. Together, we drift on the tide of popular opinion and new ideas. Well, Jesus' teaching challenges, runs counter to the prevailing worldview in our culture. He suggests that if we really want to survive or prevail through the storms that life throws our way, we need to think carefully about what it is that we're actually anchored to. How firm is the foundation upon which we're building our lives. And a lot of people in our culture, maybe in our families, have ditched the church and the trappings of religion because why? They say it's old-fashioned, too rigid, out of date. Freedom and the ability to float along with the crowd is the better way to go. Our Western culture that we're a part of has pulled up its anchor. We are disconnected from historical foundations. We are holding to and proclaim. I mean, the idea of holding to and proclaiming what the Bible teaches about things like morality is now deemed offensive and even labeled as hate speech. And it is simply staggering just how far our culture has shifted in the place of a couple of decades. Now, Jesus challenged people, stop and think about the foundations upon which you're building your life. Is it solid? Is it durable? Is it time-tested? Will it withstand the storms that are common to and wash over us all? There's one more principle that we could look at. It makes sense to follow the manufacturer's instructions. I mean, when it comes to knowing how something works, how best it's designed, surely the person who designed it has the best idea. The manufacturer's instructions are based upon superior knowledge and experience. Now, the other day, we bought a different car, and I'm now working through the manufacturer's manual to see how best it actually ought to work. There are some things which I can work out, but there are some things which I could try and program in that are not the way it was actually designed, and to go back to the manufacturer's specifications makes an awful lot of sense. Well, the original designer knows what a product or a community is intended to do or be used for and its inherent limitations. We ignore the manufacturer's advice at our peril. I mean, was that what Jesus was alluding to when he said, therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. Conversely, everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on sand. So what did Jesus mean when he referred to these words of mine here? Well, there are several theories. We could take these verses as the summation, the culminating, concluding statement at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, and we could marvel at the kind of things that Jesus actually addressed in his famous sermon. He talked about how to find real happiness. He talked about how to love our enemies. He talked about marriage and keeping right relationships. He talked about sexual ethics, revenge in the face of people that give us a hard time. He talked about being honest in our dealings with people and in business. He talked about how to pray. He talked about worry and how fruitless that actually is because God cares for us. He talked about how to cope with anxiety, how to be generous, how to avoid criticism. When we put the words of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount into practice, well, that's a great foundation upon which to build a life for the future. Then another way to understand what Jesus meant by listening to and doing his words is to refer to all of the life teaching and the life role modeling of Jesus of Nazareth that is recorded in the New Testament. And when we take Jesus seriously, when we read and ponder and try to do the kind of things that he said we should do, when we align ourselves with his values and join him in relationship with his Father in heaven, oh my goodness, we are building a life that is anchored to a durable foundation. The storms will come, the floods will rise, but we are anchored to something which is solid. There may be another way that we could understand the words and teaching of Jesus might be to take what we might call his executive summary of all the laws of the Lord. Remember in Matthew 22, Jesus was being goaded by a group of religious leaders that were trying to entrap him into saying the wrong thing. And they asked him, which is the greatest commandment that God has given? And Jesus replied, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment, and the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commands. Now there is a life foundation to live for. Love God, love everyone else. Or as Saint Augustine put it, love God and do what you will. For when we truly love God, we will live in such a way that we do what he wants us to do or refrain from doing what he doesn't want us to do. And one of the greatest ways to demonstrate genuine love for God is to love other people. But it's worth noting also that Jesus didn't simply say listen to or even to know his words. He also says that we need to obey them. Hearing or knowing the words of Jesus without putting them into practice, actually that's worse than being ignorant of Jesus' teaching. Knowledge and intellect are not the same thing as wisdom. It's possible to know a lot, but not do a lot. And James, again, had something great to say along these lines when he said, do not merely listen to the word and so deceive yourselves. Do what it says. Anyone who listens to the word but does not do what it says is like someone who looks at his face in a mirror and after looking at himself goes away and immediately forgets what he looks like. Or to put that another way, we haven't really listened to the words of Jesus until or unless they have entered our being in such a way that they find expression in how we live. Now, you see, the words, the teaching of Jesus, that they are not just clever rhetoric or well-thought-out philosophy, that they're more than just a code of ethics to live by or a list of rules. They're more like words of eternal life that reconcile sinful men and women to a relationship with God. They demand a personal response and a commitment. To follow the words and the teachings of Jesus means that one actually comes into relationship with God for themselves, whereby we are cleansed, we are forgiven our past mistakes, we are given a brand new life for the future. It's a bit like a reconstruction process, a makeover of a house on a whole new rock foundation. A person in relationship with God has character and strength and power and the perpetual presence of God constantly with them in order to cope with the storms that rage against us all. There are cynics of the Christian faith who say, trusting in God like this, that's a crutch. Or as the quote that's attributed to Karl Marx expressed it, religion, that's the opiate of the masses. Maybe that's not an accusation that we should shy away from. I'm not sure I want to argue with it. For if you travel through life with a broken leg, it makes good sense to walk with a crutch. To do without is to wobble around in constant pain and deformity. Now, the fact of the matter is, we live in a world where storms happen. We all traverse our way through life with a metaphorical brokenness. The storms are unavoidable. They're common to us all. They teach us a lot about our character, and being a follower of Jesus, at no stage are we ever told that we will be immune to storms in life. The issue is how we traverse and make our way through them. Which I guess raises the all-important question that we must answer for ourselves. Where do we today stand in response to the words of Jesus? Verses 28 and 29 in the verses that we read before, it notes how when Jesus finished speaking, the people in his original audience were amazed at his teaching. He spoke as someone with divine authority, in contrast to the corrupt and the hypocritical teaching that was given by religious leaders of the day. People were forced to decide their response to Jesus. And so are we today. On what foundation are we building our lives? Is it merely the popular teaching and values, the paradigms of the world in which we live? Is it a philosophy of seeking after happiness that craves riches and things and power over people? Or have we chosen the countercultural values and the worldview of the kingdom of God? Are we building on sand that is so easily washed away, or are we building on the rock? And I simply want to say at the end of this series that if you have never, up to this point in your life, resolved to begin a relationship with God and to build for the rest of your time on this mortal coil your life based upon the solid, rock-like teaching of Jesus, for goodness sake, choose to do so. Turn your thoughts in God's direction. Talk to him. Ask him to reveal more of himself to you. Ask him to forgive your past mistakes, which we all have. Put your hand metaphorically into his and invite him to help you cross the busy streets in life amidst the storms that come our way. And I guarantee you that as he places his spirit within you, you will begin to discover within yourself character and strength that enable you to go through the storms of life with hope and face the future. The choice is up to us. How do we respond to the words and the teaching of Jesus? Let's pray together.